think you've been most patient for an hour and 45 minutes, and I'm sure those seats do get hard in spite of the stimulation of the speakers. So I'll take this opportunity to ask you to stand and stretch, and those who would like to leave at this time may do so without embarrassment. To present us with some comments on Mr. Mailer's address.
Well, just to keep the ball rolling, I would try to riff on some of the things that Norman Mailer has said, and especially concerning the future of Alaska and the nature of the minority experience. I tend not to see things as finely as he does, and I think that over and beyond any question of major majority and minority, there is a built-in problem for the individual who grows up in this particular type of society, and that is the task of constantly pressing the extent of one's own consciousness to conceive and to render experience into consciousness, and thus to be aware of its implications, morally and otherwise. I think that this is the American challenge, not of any mystical thing which happened, but precisely because of the mobility of the country, because of this great landmass where even today I am saying you can come here and if you do the right things for a long enough time, you can come into the possession of homesteads. This is quite wonderful. But with that physical possibility goes the obligation to constantly live in terms of your own sense of what is real, your own sense of values, to fight for those values against all the claims of people around you. And I'm quite in agreement with his warnings that each, and I'm going to paraphrase it, that each new state is a new chance to actually make the ideal manifest within society. And this does not happen if we are not conscious in what we select from the states down below, from the class above, from what we allow to influence us. Because over and over again in this country, we throw away very good things in favor of something very tawdry. I was absolutely amazed when I went to a party at a very fancy and sophisticated home, the home of editor of a national magazine, a painter and so on, and there were many, many illustrious people around. But at a certain moment, a woman screamed and said, "Oh, the Beatles!" And they ran to the television set. This was to get before the word got around. Like, I hadn't gotten the word. So I pressed through the crowd to look at the television set. I was rather aghast, not by the fun that the Beatles were having, but that I knew where they came from, and it had been here all the time, give or take. You see, we always go for the feedback, and the feedback that we get from oppositions, whether it's minority states, to call this Texas shrinking state a minority state takes a lot of nerve, all right? But the feedback can very often be one of distortion, one which reduces and kills off that which is possible. That is, it will kill off the possibility of creating that which is new. I suppose what I'm saying is We have to trust ourselves. We have to trust the reality of our own experience. And that is one of the most important obligations of Americans. And this, in turn, obligates us to fight definitions which are pushed upon us from those outside, no matter how powerful, no matter how lustrous, no matter how much we admire them. I know that as I read novels, especially as I read earlier, when I was trying to learn what novels were all about and trying to understand them in terms of my own experience, over and over again, I finally had to say, well, this is a great man and so on, but he doesn't know certain things about people that I know, because the people that I know would not have acted in this particular way under these particular circumstances. And it didn't mean that I felt that he was lying or inaccurate, but that he simply wasn't omniscient. Trust to ourselves, celebrate life as we know it, take the very best we can from the past and from those around us, and be very conscious about it and very chill.
Thank you. Mr. Mather, your comments, and Mr. Ellis.
To go back again to the time that Ralph Ellis and I spoke in Iowa, Ed Skillings tonight mentioned a remark that Mr. Ellis had made on that occasion, which this country was founded by writers, which impressed me extraordinarily at the time, because part of everything else gave a certain importance again to the idea of being a writer. It really gave me great pause. It was finally, this was perhaps the one country in the history of the world whose beginnings were created very much by writers, and by writers wrote extraordinarily as well. Now, later today, talking about the subtlety of folklore and the extraordinary detail of subtlety of being a member of a minority group in a specific place, with all that means in terms of being a member of that minority group in that place, not some other place, what specifically is Ralph Ellis went on being Indian in Oklahoma, with Oklahoma's extraordinarily specific historical relation to Negroes, Indians, and frontier. He made the most forceful point that a writer writes best about felt life, using James' remark, that he writes best in writing about what he knows. And Carlson then quoted Hemingway. Now, I think that's generally true, and I think it has an extraordinary application to Alaska, because there are going to be writers up here developing. They can develop only by recognizing that the quality and character of Alaska life is totally different from the life anywhere else. And before they can write anything good at all, they're probably going to have to write something original. You see, any style or attempt to capture the ways of other writers, of very good city writers and provincial writers in America, would almost obligatorily have to fail because it's an artificial center of it. However, I would like to take issue with one aspect of what you said, though, Ralph, which is I think that beyond this matter of writing about what one knows, there is also what you can call an act of psychic appropriation. One of the things I think often characterizes the great writers is that they very often are quite bad or slipshod about details, but some of their details are brilliant and extraordinary, and others are just inaccurate. And anyone who knows anything about the subject can know that they're silly. For example, Thomas Sowell was probably not a great writer, but I thought he was a great writer when I read him in college, and maybe I would have been able to read him again. But anyway, the thing about Wolfe, one of the some marvelous about Wolfe, and almost attractive and very funny, was willing to know so much about one thing and so little about another, and wrote about both matters with the same thundering intensity. But what happened is that his method, he was like a great big fullback who could never get the play straight. You see, they've got so much power, they can steal that ball, and I'll eat it up, you know. And so he was saying, he'd go, you know, he'd go. And of course, he'd go, he'd get elbows in people's eyes, and, you know, knock people down, and gain yardage. And what did that? And that is one kind of psychic procreation, which is a sheer, you know, will and determination to move. But I think it also is a kind of extraordinary psychic procreation of the sort. Let's say that Henry James used in disobeying his own recipes, as we all do, in the princess, I can never pronounce her name,
Casamassima. Some say.
Well, Princess Casamassima, which I've never read. It's a book I've never read, but everyone tells me that James had some extraordinary things to say about the nature of the revolutionary spirit in that book. And if it'll help me in my argument, I'm willing to believe it. Okay. That actually was the thing I think we'll probably have to potentially discuss over beers one day. Is this matter of the relation between writing on one's nose and writing with a guest that involves one's entire nature? And I just finish it off just to bring it back to Alaska. It's just something that the Alaskan writer, when they develop, I think, is going to write the very face of the state. He's going to help create the state in a way few writers can. He also, I think, is going to have to write, knowing all he knows, he's also going to make some of these extraordinary imaginative leaps. He's going to conceive of Alaskans who aren't even born yet. I don't mean that he will conceive them 30 years from now. I mean, he'll have people in his books, conceivably, who don't yet exist, but they will come start to exist because he wrote about them. Just as in taking it in reverse, just as businessmen no longer are like Babbitt because they've read it.
I invite questions from the audience. Yes, sir.
Mr. Ellison, he suggested he had a theory as to why we buy popular myths and oppress reality, and I'd like to hear that.
I will repeat the question for the tape recorder. The question was addressed to Mr. Ellison as his theory on myths and reality.
Well, that's a big order, but I'll make a stab at trying to spell out the theory. I think that one reason that Americans are so willing to accept some of the popular myths of the American experience is it makes it unnecessary for us to confront the implications of our own conduct. And so we go on. We want to forget the past because in memory there is pain. In the conscious and conscientious confrontation between that is of the conflict between our ideals and our conduct, we have to do something about it. So we don't want to do this. And I will go further to speak historically and say that perhaps we would not have gotten certain things done in the States, certainly after the Civil War, if we had been very careful. I know it's awful for a Negro to say this, and yet I look and I see. I don't know it would have been better if we had thought a little bit more about what we had promised ourselves to do. But one way that we helped ourselves to forget was instead of creating a great dramatic literature, we had Al Jolson singing, as I saw him recently on an old movie in television, Al Jolson in black face singing, I don't want to make your laws, I don't want to change your laws, and so on. I just want to sing my songs and be happy. it was entertainment. It was certainly a part of the myth of the happy Negro. But historically, we know that Negroes were not only trying to change the laws, they were getting knocked on the head for trying to do so. It is the desire to forget about problems which we feel that we can't solve in order to go on and get a little money in the bank. I like to talk about literature because there's always things, you know, in a good writer, and I agree with Mailer, where the work of the imagination very often will get things in which are missed by the critics. And I'm referring to the beginning of The Great Gatsby, where the narrator tells you, by way of putting his credentials on the table, that he had a little money. And the money came from an Irish uncle who had come over just before the Civil War, who had paid a substitute to fight for him while he went on and made a lot of money. This sort of slides by, but it didn't slide by Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald understood the moral implication of that act, and he was saying that I'm involved in, I'm directly involved, and involved through my own family tradition and some of the wrongs which made Gatsby do what he did, and also which led him to his death. Maybe that's why we have to have intuitive writers as well as conscious writers. They will tell us the truths about ourselves which we dare not face consciously in our day-to-day conduct.
I see no hand, so I'll ask a question, if I may. Mr. Mailer, I was impressed with what appeared to me the basic philosophy that ran through your presentation, that it wasn't a question of cultures in conflict, but it was really a problem of cultures in emulation, that the minority group in struggling with the group in power might emulate it, that Alaska might emulate the lower 48, etc., and that the basic process seemed to be one of, not of conflict, but emulation that concerned you. Did I read you correctly?
Well, I think in fact probably to clarify something. As I think Richard Nixon used to say, I'm glad you brought that up. And I think the nature of conflict, of course, is an active and motile word. It doesn't apply to direct confrontation and warfare. But of course, in reality, the nature of conflict is that it goes through all forms. And perhaps the most insidious form of it, the most plaguing form of conflict, is exactly an emulation that has nothing of love or interest in it, but is an emulation which of opposites. In other words, when something is taken on from an outside culture, not because it's violent from its own culture, but because it works in the other culture. I mean, for instance, the aspect of Japanese culture which is least appealing to us is that slavish devotion they have to everything American. The Japanese have an extraordinary culture, and their culture is very much in conflict with ours, certainly was a period ago. It was perhaps most common with ours in the occupation, the war was over, but the impact of the American army upon Japan and Japan upon us American soldiers was obviously very intense, and while it was not warlike, it was in many ways agreeable still, there obviously, just by the sheer operating definition of it, two countries were in conflict. What happens to Japan began to emulate it? I think emulation is one of the, is the least interesting manifestation of conflict, and the most dangerous. Because it can vitiate the younger culture. You see, so it never finds its own true nature. And of course, something I was saying earlier is that the culture does not find its true nature. It's an unhealthy, unpleasant, disagreeable culture, which can end up producing barbarities and monstrosities in history.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask this here, May, why do Americans not want to be involved with personalities of their own? I'm referring to the incident that happened in the States here last year, the murder of a young girl where numerous people saw the thing and yet no one did anything about it. I can go beyond that into areas here and other places where I've been and things I've seen. Why? You say there is we're becoming barbaric. Well, why is it to the extent that it involves people that should help each other?
Why are people today avoiding involvement?
I think if we're to discuss that situation that happened in New York, where 38 people were witnesses to the murder of this young girl, I don't know what she says that absolutely could never happen here. I mean, I don't believe it could. There are many reasons for it. But I think the answer is the same reason that if you go to the best restaurant in New York, you can predict what the maitre d' will look like, and he in turn will know what you are in a glance, and will assign you to your slot. And that is that people are extraordinarily depersonalized, precisely because a society has an outline which is very strong and very detailed, and in which everything has been pulled out and worked out, and there's very little room for individual temperament compared to things like Alaska. So by the same token, it's much harder for people to move out of their predictable patterns. And in New York, since that can't satisfy what gets, that's an abstract explanation. One of the other difficulties is that everybody who lives in New York knows two things. Which is one, don't ever get involved with the police. Because you'll lose 2 or 3 days, one way or another. You know, even if you're not only innocent, but in fact, an agent of crime. And the other, because like, don't ever find a traffic ticket in New York, because justice is a cash register. The other thing that people know in New York is that all sorts of story things are happening all the time, and if they pay no attention to them, what they discover is that their cowardly instinct was right 9 times out of 10. You start in bed one night, you hear a girl screaming on the street, you stick your head out the window, and she's not screaming at the pain, she's screaming at the light. These are amazing falls in New York. And so what happens is these people who are listening, it took an awful lot of time to get through their heads that girl was really favored and really in trouble. In fact, she was screaming, help, save me, police, but nothing. It's like saying exhausting about it, But I think the other thing you find was that they then became something that we really just all miss about, which is there is a playing loose, and this was finally the only excuse for it. I think the reason it happened finally was just that this playing was part of it, and there's a profound apathy of people one to another in the most developed centers of American culture, and I'm sure in other cultures as well, but I'm going to speak on the line now.
That if the minority groups and the new barbarianism affect the revolution, he said something to the effect that they must attain some sort of excellence in themselves or we are lost. I was wondering, I'm assuming that you envisioned something else if we weren't lost, if I'm correct in assuming this.
I'd like
to see what you do
with
vision if the revolution is
successful.
Mr. Mailer,
if we're not lost, where are we?
I think the question is if we're not lost, where would we be? I think we might have not only have motorcycles on the moon, but I think we will also have Renaissance man in full command of his technological powers, and that's something that's beyond the imagination of any of us. I think we could certainly still have an extraordinary world. I think we were born to create that extraordinary world. I'd like to ask a question of Mr. Ellison, which is that when you talk about that the memory of the past is painful. I wonder if we go along with it instead of agreeing or disagreeing that the final reason it's painful is because it's so damn guilty. Like any country that advances at the rate we've advanced has had to leave, has had all sorts of people behind, all sorts of worries, very sore, and had to be broken. And all of us move upon a collective guilt of the past, and so we destroy the past. And destroying the past, we make our future absolutely frantic and hysterical, because without a sense of the past, it's hard to steer your course. It's like being the boat without a rudder.
Yes, I would agree with that. However, I always go back to the individual, and one way of dealing with guilt is to transform it into consciousness. There's no way of living without being guilty, certainly not in this country. Somebody's going to get hurt, but the inhuman thing and the thing which causes the trouble is that we forget and then try to justify the forgetting. Then we pretend that we're somebody else. Or we pretend that we make scapegoats out of others who are supposed to take over the burden of our own guilt. So much so that we can't allow the other person to have a past which is as complex as ours, as wonderful as ours, or even to have their own burden of guilt. So everything kind of snowballs, and this creates this kind of chaos of which you're speaking. Over and over again, you know, you think of I had the kind of thing happen to me recently. I made certain assertions out of my own arrogance and humility and reading and identification with things of literature and of culture and so on. I thought I was saying something responsible, at least as far as my own experience was concerned. And this man who responded to me treated me as though I were out of my place. You know, he in his own economy, and he was not a man who's consciously prejudiced, but he had decided that, all right, you belong over there. And as I said to a friend of his, well, he treats me as though my parents had to be taught to speak English. It's that complicated. What one does about it, beyond being aware and trying to avoid it, I don't know. I think finally it's something that you can't legislate. Maybe you can educate. I suppose that's what's happening here tonight.
Individual, and I grew up miles away from Tobacco Road and went to college and everything in Georgia. And one of the things that has occurred since I have come to Alaska is that you can't act as an individual anymore. Now, back in the 30s and 40s, we haven't touched on any of the real harsh things that are happening, and the papers here haven't touched on it, and now we're getting faced with it in our own state here. But I can remember we always acted and we did these things. We didn't know about the little humiliations, but we knew about harmful things. And I can remember that as individuals, every one of us operated on a certain level to make right these things, don't you see? And I can remember that nobody was really scared as individuals. And when the buses didn't pick up our neighboring Negro children while we'd get in cars, take them if it was raining, and nobody stopped, don't you know? And I can remember hilariously throwing crosses back and forth to the Ku Klux Klan all one Sunday, about five of us, don't you know? And we throw them back. So finally they went home, and here come this old Pinewood horse at the back door, and they flung them across. So we all got in our car. We knew where it came from, which we recognized the light about. We drive up, and we said, John, if you go throw crosses in our backyard, the children sleep in the backyard, you don't want to worry about the backyard, the children throw them in the front. Now, I have been in Alaska since 58, and I always, we had something like 800 or 900 Negroes on our payroll, when they got in trouble, and if the court wasn't right, we'd walk up right straight up and we'd say we want a jury trial. Now, no one really clipped me for that. I was getting up in the night and everybody else was in our group. Dozens of us in Georgia and Florida in the 30s and 40s. And we'd call a sheriff 100 miles away and say, we want this man out tonight. Maybe we'd be down there in pajamas. But we did something. Now we go back home and we have this huge infiltration of people now in Alaska who are bringing this superation in, and we're just helpless as individuals. We don't know how to go. We go back and the white people who were absolutely part of us at that time, they no longer are. They don't talk, they don't communicate. We have no communication there. And unless we belong or know how to function through some group as a person, we can't do a damn thing without being
Mr. Ellison, has it been your experience that individual action has decreased in favor of group action?
I think, however, that the best sort of group action is made up of individuals who have banded together and decided that this is the way to solve certain problems. It's happening in Mississippi and Alabama. I don't see why it can't happen in Alaska if it needs be. But to get back to what Norman Mailer had to say, one of the dangers that you find in a new state when there's an infiltration of people, I know where I speak. I lost my mother in Ohio in the 30s. She had moved there from Oklahoma, where I'd been brought up. By that time, I was in college. I went to her funeral in Cincinnati, and there was a whole colony of Negroes from White Oak, Georgia, who had gone to Cincinnati years before, but whose folkways were very much the same, whose possession of the city was almost nil. They did not live in Cincinnati, and it was their own fault, because they didn't take the head-whipping of the discomfort of whatever was necessary, which some of them had taken in Georgia. Once they got to Cincinnati, the ceremony of being in a land with wide opportunities just dried up their will to do the pioneering effort. And every American has to undergo this pioneer sacrifice. He has to take his chances. He has to fight. He has to fight as they did in Oklahoma, when I'm told the whites and the Negroes used to get together and take axe handles to the polling places when there were efforts to keep Negroes from the franchise. I'm afraid that these conflicts have to be gone through, and you're very fortunate that it's happening so late at so late a time up here at the top of the world. Getting together. Otherwise, they will be burning crosses on their own lawns, and they won't even know they're doing it.
In order that many of you might have the opportunity to meet the gentleman before you leave, I'm going to declare the formal part of this meeting adjourned. Remind you again of the Festival of Arts rich program this coming week and next Sunday afternoon.